Before we begin our proceedings, I'd just like to thank the law school, its faculty and deans for making this event possible, and we appreciate their cooperation with our team in setting this all up. The first case for argument this morning is 17-2369, Forest Laboratories versus Sigma Farm Laboratories. Mr. Katz?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm getting logisticated here. Come on, please proceed.
May I proceed?
Yes, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. The district court erred in construing claim one of the 476 patent by limiting the claim to one of the preferred embodiments. The district court then erred again by taking this incorrect claim construction and finding claim one non-obvious.
Okay, let me stop you just because there's a lot going on in this case and I found it challenging to go through this. Can I ask you, though, in connection with claims 1 and 4, you make only, I think, in two pages, an indefiniteness argument, because under the court's construction, she's woven in, right? You're looking at
That's
me,
like
you don't know what I'm talking about.
That's correct.
Thinking maybe I got the wrong case. Okay. You barely pressed that on appeal, and the other says that you've waived it. So, and you didn't mention that here, so let me take that off the table. Let me ask you about the district court, though. It seems like bioavailability was your one and only argument for obviousness at the hearing, before the district court. Is that because she had not yet construed claim one? Or because you press other arguments of obviousness on appeal, not the bioavailability. And the only reason I can think of is because I think it preceded the claim construction on claim one.
Well, we didn't get the claim construction until the court's decision. We had additional motivation arguments during the trial. In addition to bioavailability, we had motivations based on compliance. Claim one, we did have arguments about the claim construction during the trial. And those compliance motivations were at issue for claim one during the trial.
So with respect to claim one and claim four, I'm trying to figure out what difference it makes whether claim one is obvious. Is the idea that if claim one is obvious, then there's non-infringement with respect to a couple of parties with respect to claim four under your view? Is that the only reason that we're considering separately the obviousness of claim one and claim four?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First, Breckenridge and Olympic were found not to infringe claim four. So Breckenridge and Olympic do not need to establish that claim four is invalid.
But they'd infringe claim one.
No, the district court found that Breckenridge and Olympic did not infringe claim four. Yeah.
What about claim one?
In claim one, claim one is different from claim four because the scope is different. If the claim one is properly construed,
they found to infringe claim one? Judge Dyke is trying to understand what the procedural issues
yes,
are.
Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor, yes. Breckenridge, the defendants conceded infringement on claim one.
Okay, is that the only difference between claim one and claim four? So is if we conclude that there's non-infringement of claim four, then as to those two parties, they don't care about the obviousness issue with respect to claim one or claim four, presumably.
They do.
So they do because they were still found to infringe claim one.
Correct.
Under the current claim constructions.
So for my client, Breckenridge, we need to show that claim one is invalid, and we need this court to uphold the district court's opinion that Breckenridge does not infringe claim four.
Okay. Could you address then the claim construction on claim one? I take it your point is that it's written broadly, and it's not limited to sublingual and buccal administration, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I could direct your attention to the patent in column one, appendix 95. What the district court did was read in one of the preferred embodiments. But when you look at the specification lists a number of embodiments. Starting on line 47 of column 1, it talks about an embodiment that is an aqueous solution. The next paragraph talks about a preferred pharmaceutical composition that rapidly disintegrates, which is the claim limitation of claim 1, but is also administered sublingually or buccally. And that lines up with claim 9 of the patent. The next paragraph is another preferred embodiment. It says, in a preferred embodiment, and it goes on to explain that the composition rapidly disintegrates. And that lines up with claim 1. So you have one preferred embodiment that is a rapidly disintegrating composition without regard to route of administration, and you have another preferred embodiment which lines up with claim 9, which is a rapidly disintegration that specifies sublingual or buccal administration.
Well, wait, maybe I'm confusing this, but I thought the basis for the court's claim construction was based on prosecution history. Right? I mean, it wasn't dealing with the specification. It was just what was given up in prosecution.
That's part of it.
Okay. Well, why was she wrong about that? It seems like that was pretty clear on the record. You're obviously arguing that they did not give it up in prosecution?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why? Because it wasn't clear enough, or because it was they gave up something other than this?
The patentee never intended to give up a route of administration. In looking at the prosecution as a whole, it's clear that what the patentee was trying to do was distinguish its invention from the prior art 434 patent referred to as Vanderberg. Vanderberg discloses a centipine or centipine salt used to treat schizophrenia, but it discloses it as a conventional oral tablet, the kind of tablet that you would swallow whole. Nowhere in the 434 patent is there any disclosure of a rapidly disintegrating composition. So what the patentee did was distinguish its invention from the 434 patent.
Yes, but whether they had to give it up isn't the same question as whether a skilled artisan would understand the prosecution history as half giving it up. Lots and lots of patentees end up giving up a broader scope than they would have had to based on the prior art.
I understand, Your Honor, but what the patentee intended to do was only give up the conventional oral tablet. So what the examiner did was, the examiner, originally the claim was directed to a composition suitable for sublingual or buccal administration. The examiner said, well, suitable, well, maybe that would include a conventional oral tablet such as disclosed in 434. The patentee did not simply delete suitable or say the composition has to be sublingual or buccal administration. The examiner said, you need something unique about this composition so it's only sublingual. But the patentee chose not to do that. The patentee chose to distinguish it in another way. The patentee knew that the rapidly disintegrating characteristics were not unique, because if you look at column 2 of the 476 patent, it refers to rapidly disintegrating compositions according to the 516 patent. And if you look at the 516 patent, and I'll give you a cite for that.
Yes, I guess my problem is that this patent's title is sublingual or buccal pharmaceutical compositions. And throughout the specification, it uses what I would actually call magic language, because we found in other cases that this language amounts to a limiting or a disclaimer, like in column 1, where it says the invention therefore relates to sublingual or buccal pharmaceutical compositions. And it says this throughout. This language is replete throughout a very short specification. So, given that, and given that there is prosecution history language which has been construed to further accentuate that same narrowing, I don't know. I'm having trouble understanding your argument that claim 1 should not be so limited. If there were no spec, no prosecution history, I would agree with you on claim 1. But in light of the spec and the prosecution history, why doesn't this fall right within the line of cases where we've held, if the specification makes it clear that your invention is this, that this is your invention, then all the claims are going to be limited to that?
Well, first, we don't think the specification makes that clear. We think, based on column 1, that there's a preferred embodiment that is both rapidly disintegrating and administered sublingually.
Just to be clear, so when this specification says in many places, like column 1, line 5, the invention relates, the first sentence of the specification, the invention relates to a sublingual or buccal pharmaceutical composition, and more specifically, to a sublingual or buccal composition for the treatment of various mental disorders. You don't think that's limiting?
No,
don't think that falls right in line with our disclaimer cases, that when you say the present invention relates to, because I wrote one of them, the present invention relates to, you don't think that's right in line with those cases that said when you use that language, those are like magic words?
No, because there's also disclosure of a pharmaceutical composition without regard to the administration, the route of administration. And if you look at Claim 9, it has both limitations. It has the rapidly disintegrating limitation as well as the sublingual or buccal limitation. If those were one and the same, then you wouldn't need both limitations. During claim construction proceedings, the court was asked whether or not...
Wait, no. Claim 9 relates to a rapid disintegration when it is put into the buccal pouch or placed under the tongue. So isn't that the same thing?
No, these are two separate limitations.
I don't understand. I guess I thought this was related to sublingual or buccal pharmaceutical compositions. Can you explain what those words mean, just so I'm not mistaken?
Sublingual is under the tongue and buccal is in the cheek.
Okay,
what you're saying is that if there's a dependent claim that includes a limitation for buccal and sublingual administration, that means that the independent claim can't be limited to that.
Well, I'm saying that in part. I mean, this isn't dependent on Claim 1. But what I'm saying is that the two claim limitations in Claim 9 indicate that these are two separate claim limitations.
Two different.
Claim 9 depends on Claim 4, right?
Say that again, Your Honor?
Claim 9 depends on Claim 4.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if I could just make one point in the prosecution.
And her point, just let me go further so it's not missed. Her point is that Claim 4 expressly requires sublingual or buccal. So do you think Claim 9 can... Do you think a dependent claim is capable of broadening the independent claim to which it depends? As a matter of patent law, that's a no. There's no way you can.
No, we're not saying that, Your Honor. Our point is only that there are two separate claim limitations. And if I could just point you to one sentence in one page in the prosecution history, Appendix 1003. And I see that I'm running out of time, so
no,
I'm
I have a few more questions. Okay. You're not going to go anywhere yet. So
what page in the appendix?
Appendix 1003.
That's in volume 2?
That's in volume 2, yes.
Okay.
Now, this was the response by the patentee after the claim was rejected. And when the patentee changed it to the rapidly the sublingual or buccal administration limitation to the rapidly disintegrating limitation. And if you look at the last sentence in the second paragraph, it says, thus the compositions of the present invention and the compositions of Vandenberg are mutually exclusive. This shows what the patentee was trying to do. It was trying to distinguish its invention from the prior art Vandenberg invention. And it was doing this with the rapid disintegration characteristic.
I have to be honest. You're pulling a piece of hay out of a haystack and expecting me to name it. I don't understand the import that you're giving to this sentence, and nor did you sort of pull it out and explore it in your brief. So I don't know what I'm supposed to take away from this sentence. I don't understand your argument. Something I do want to ask you about. I am troubled. I'm not at all troubled by her claim construction on Claim 1. You've probably figured that out already. But I am troubled by some of the decision-making in the secondary consideration space, and in particular, the unexpected results, which, if I understand it right, is based exclusively on secret stuff nobody knew about. So I'm kind of curious how something could be deemed unexpected to a person of skill in the art when they never actually knew about any of the underlying findings.
We agree with that completely, Your Honor. We don't believe it's unexpected. In fact, when you look at what was disclosed was the IV study, which is the closest prior art, that there were no side effects. So if a person of ordinary skill...
But this is almost a matter of law question, so more than a matter of fact in this case, because I understand the facts. I mean, I'm thinking as a matter of law, I don't see how you can find unexpected results to a skilled artisan when the skilled artisan would have no reason to understand know about the underlying problem that supposedly existed. I mean, do you have a problem with that? I mean, that would be a broad, that'd be a broad holding. It would affect, you know, the unexpected results space.
That is what we argue.
Double down on that? Because I have the same concerns about the long-felt need secondary consideration. that for purposes of motivation, she found that the conventional forms were safe, bioavailable, and clinically effective. And then she finds a long-felt need in the art for safe and effective forms of this drug. That seems to me to be a tension between those two.
Yes, Your Honor, and along the same lines as the nexus that Judge Moore pointed out, what sublingual acenapine was solving, supposedly, was the cardiotoxic side effects. But what they said itself, in terms of long-felt but unmet need, were reduced EPS and other side effects that you get from antipsychotics. I'd like to reserve some time for...
Yeah, but we're still not done with you.
Okay.
So one of the things I don't really understand, that long-felt need argument, so you're going to need to spend just a little bit more time explaining it to me, because, I mean, I think the motivation to combine analysis is for the specific motivation to combine acenapine, if I'm saying that right, with a buccal or sublingual formulation or administration. Whereas with the long-felt need, I thought I understood the facts to present and for her holding her fact-finding to be that there existed a lot of, even if there had been a motivation to combine those things, there were a lot of side effects present that this particular combination were able to obviate, and that those side effects had been known for a long time and that there was an interest in eliminating them or reducing them. So I guess I don't see that inconsistency the same way.
I guess number one, it's the parent compound that would have solved the side effects from antipsychotics, not the rapid disintegration aspect of it. Number two, Forrest expert Dr. McIntyre admits that there's still a need for new atypical antipsychotics. So it didn't fill the need even as to the typical side effects you receive from antipsychotics.
The fact that somebody said there's still a need for more, there's always a need for more, right? Isn't there? I mean, aren't there always a need? None of these mental health drugs are perfect. None of them work perfectly. You know, there's always a need for more. That can't be it. Okay, I have one other question for you, if you don't mind. I actually want to ask you about Claim 4. I realize that's the cross appeal, but your time on rebuttal is going to be really limited, so I'm going to open the door now, if you don't mind.
Okay.
So I'm a little concerned about the court's construction of the excitation limitation in Claim 4. So could you spend about a minute or two on that for me?
Sure. During claim construction proceedings, the court was asked whether or not the term excitation disorder includes...
There's no term excitation disorder in this claim.
It says tension, excitation, anxiety, and psychotic and schizophrenic disorders.
Right.
And so the court was asked to determine whether or not that phrase included manic or mixed episodes associated with bipolar 1 disorder, which we refer to in our briefs as bipolar mania. The district court found that as of 1994, that bipolar mania was a well-defined term, and a person of ordinary skill in the art would have expected to see that term if that disorder was covered.
Okay, but is there such a thing called an excitation disorder under the DSM or the medical criteria anywhere?
No, there's no...
In fact, both experts, everyone agreed. There's
right.
No, just like there's no such thing as attention disorder, right? There's no such thing as attention disorder. There's no such thing as an excitation disorder. Both experts agreed. I'm not just making this
right.
up. Okay, so there's no such thing as an excitation disorder. So we're already in a place where that construction feels a little bit odd to me that she would... say, because there is such thing as anxiety disorder, there is such thing as a psychotic disorder, there is such thing as a schizophrenic disorder, but there's no such thing as attention disorder or excitation. So what do those words mean? So for me, I generally look to the spec when there's some confusion for me like that. So in this spec, do you know where excitation appears? It appears twice.
It should appear in column 1 at line 44.
Correct.
And then it appears again in talking about the Beagle Dog study.
Right, and it's really interesting. When it talks about the Beagle Dog study, doesn't it seem to be treating excitation in that discussion as a symptom of something, as opposed to a particular disease? Because it says, when dogs, I mean, this is the awful thing, they gave dogs these antipsychotic drugs as part of the testing to see what the side effects would be. These cute little beagles got hyped up on these antipsychotic drugs. And so what they measured is, which dogs got more excited? I'd love to see what that looks like. Is it, do they jump up and down? Do they bark a lot? I mean, I'd actually really be curious to see how they measure excitation in a dog. But in any event, so they had these beagles, and they gave some of them the drugs orally and some of them the drugs sublingually, and then they watched them to see which set of dogs got more excited. Doesn't that, I mean, my children get excited all the time. I wouldn't say they have an excitation disorder, although I might actually say they have excitation disorder. But do you see what I'm saying? The specification clearly uses this term not as a disorder, but as a symptom that someone could exhibit while on drugs.
No, but the specification refers to it as a disorder.
No, stay on column 5. Stay on column 5, use of the
well,
word.
Well, and here I think
excitation... Explain to me how it could mean what you say it means.
Excitation, I think, is being used differently here because here...
Oh, so this excitation is not the claimed excitation?
No, because here the acetylene is...
Interesting.
Here the acetylene is causing the excitation, whereas what the claim is treating excitation. These are two different things.
Wait. Why do you think it's causing the excitation as opposed to... my dog is actually excited all the time, especially when I walk in the door. So why do you think it's causing it?
Because it's comparing which dogs were less excited after receiving the acetylene, as opposed to treating dogs that are already excited.
I don't see how it says that. I mean, dogs... First off, dogs are excited all the time. I mean, not very many dogs are totally docile, but... So dogs are excited, and this is saying, let's give them these drugs and see which ones are more excited afterwards and which ones are less excited afterwards. I don't know. It seems to me that this, in fact, this exact test was meant to demonstrate the efficacy of the drug that they were claiming, wasn't it?
I don't agree that I mean, they put forth this test to demonstrate that there were reduced side effects. So there was reduced... excitation as compared to...
I know your time's way up, so let me just tell you where I am on it. You can think about it, then you come up on rebuttal and craft an argument that would best to my thoughts. My thoughts are Claim 4 covers a series of symptoms, including tension and excitation. Bipolar mania, there's no doubt that that is a form of excitation. In fact, there's testimony in the record that says that. It's like the epitome of excitation, right? It's mania, which is sort of like super-duper excited. And so I think... that what this claim should be construed as, since its use in the specification goes to symptoms, is if this method would treat the symptom of excitation, even if it doesn't treat all the other symptoms of a given disease, then it falls within these claims. So you don't have to answer it. It was more of a statement than a question, but you can think about it, and maybe on rebuttal you can let me know what's wrong with what I said, okay?
Okay. Can I have a couple of minutes, even though my time is up, for rebuttal?
You're willing to start rebuttal.
Oh, thank you.
So you're going to think about it on rebuttal, but you're not going to get any time on rebuttal, so just think. Just think.
May it please the court. Howard Levine, representing the Forest Appellees and Cross Appellant.
Let me tell you what my problem is here. Okay, it's on the motivation to combine and the argument that having a buccal or sublingual formulation would help people with difficulty swallowing. You have two prior art patents, the 423 patent, the 516 patent, that talk about sublingual formulations helping people who have difficulty swallowing. You have testimony from a couple of witnesses, McIntyre and Jacobs, that say that. I look at the district court's decision, and I don't see that the district court really addressed this. What she says at 72 and 73 is that... there's testimony that the sublingual formulation wouldn't help people who are schizophrenic because they would potentially be non-compliant. So I think there is testimony and there is finding, there are findings that it might not help somebody who had difficulty swallowing who was schizophrenic because that person could not follow the instructions. But your problem is that the claim is a lot broader than people with schizophrenic diagnosis. So why don't we need to send this back to have her address the question of whether difficulty swallowing provided a motivation to combine and to come up with a sublingual formulation to benefit non-schizophrenic patients who had difficulty swallowing?
Well, I think the answer to that question is that the testimony in the record was pretty uniform. Usually, in a case like this, our expert would say one thing, their expert would say something else.
No, the testimony in the record, almost entirely, when it says it wouldn't improve compliance, is dealing with schizophrenic patients. And my question relates to non-schizophrenic patients who have difficulty swallowing.
Right. So the evidence, their expert was asked specifically by their own counsel, would the sublingual form of Saffir's improve compliance for people who don't like or can't swallow tablets? And he said, no. And in fact,
and that testimony can be read in context as applying to schizophrenic patients, as your own witness tied it to. And the district court specifically, in her findings at 72 and 73, talks about schizophrenic patients. She hasn't addressed the question of non-schizophrenic patients. Isn't that true?
Well, the claim, acenapine is used as a...
Just start answering my question. Isn't it true that her findings were limited to compliance, it's not going to improve compliance with respect to schizophrenic patients?
I don't believe so. I really don't believe so, Your Honor. And acenapine is used to clamp down...
Well, where does she say that? You look at 73, she says, explained by Dr. McIntyre, clinicians with experience in treating schizophrenic patients understand it's sublingual patient. And then, you know, that's what the testimony, that's what his testimony is about, it's schizophrenic patients.
But the other patients that would benefit from acenapine, people with mania, people with an anxiety, people with tension, which are the features of the claim, they would all have the same sort of criteria, and there was no evidence.
Well, you're saying that, but I don't see that there's any testimony that people other than schizophrenic patients would have difficulty with compliance.
This is obviousness. The burden of proof would be on them to show that it would be obvious by clear convincing evidence.
That's surely true, but we've got to have findings about the non-schizophrenic patients,
and
those findings aren't there.
They did not argue that.
So they had the burden of proof, and they never argued that compliance problems that existed for schizophrenic patients would not similarly exist for other types.
Right. They did not argue that it would not apply to people with anxiety, with tension disorder.
Wait a moment. But they clearly argued for the universe of patients would include non-schizophrenic patients, and that there is difficulty swallowing is a motivation to combine. You came back and you said, well, no, that wouldn't be true of schizophrenic patients. The point is, that's not a rebuttal to the overall point.
I think it is, because those instructions are complicated and would need to be followed by the remember, acenapine is used for people with these excitatory features. People who are manic, schizophrenic, anxiety, and for any of that patient population, having to take the pill, having to put it under the tongue, having to keep it there, having not to swallow it, having not to chew it, and if you do swallow, it would deactivate the medicine, that would apply to all of those patient
populations. Okay, I understand the argument, but the problem is she hasn't made that finding.
Well, the problem, well...
She only made the finding about... that it wouldn't help schizophrenic patients.
But the reason she made that finding is because the defendants, the appellants, never made that argument. I mean, the district court was not, we respectfully submit, was not entitled to come up with all the hypothetical reasons to combine that could be. She was responding to the specific arguments made by the defendants.
The specific arguments made by the defendants were broader than schizophrenic patients. It just said, generally, this helps people who have difficulty swallowing.
I don't believe that was what happened at trial. I think the record at trial was pretty much directed to schizophrenic patients and patients with mania. And those were the two things they had argued on. And we put persuasive evidence for both manic and schizophrenic patients, and that would apply to anyone who has sort of these excitatory phenomenon, having to take a pill and hold it under your tongue. The other thing that I think is important, Judge Dyke, is that for decades before the filing of the patent, there were no sublingual antipsychotics. Even today, decades after the filing of the patent, there are no sublingual antipsychotics. We're the only one. And in a competitive industry like this, if there were truly advantages to patients...
Bayer undercuts your argument in that respect.
Right? I don't think it does, because in that case, in Bayer v. Watson, I think actually that's quite helpful to us. In Bayer v. Watson, there were 9 references in the prior art that specific, and I counted them, that specifically suggested making the combination of ED drugs and orally disintegrating tablets. And the response to that, well, none of them were approved. And the court rightly said, well, it takes time to approve. Here, there's no evidence ever, for decades, none of them have been approved, and there's nothing in the prior art suggesting antipsychotics for sublingual use, nothing. So we think actually Bayer supports our argument in that respect. On the motivation point.
Well, what about, didn't she answer that question in her discussion of long-felt need at A75 and 76, where she talks about what long-felt need existed for this?
Yes, well, there was definitely a long-felt need, and the long-felt need was that the in 1994, the antipsychotics that were on the market were called typical antipsychotics, and they had horrible side effects, movement disorders, all kinds of bad stuff. And so there was a need for atypical antipsychotics. There were only 2 on the market at that point in time. One of them, clozapine, had a serious white blood cell disease and could actually kill patients, and that was used very sparingly. So there was only 1, and that was risperidone, and risperidone actually caused breast growth in men and lactation, and it was not used for that reason by a lot of people. So there was clearly a need for another medicine, an atypical antipsychotic that fit that bill. And this one in particular did, and the sublingual formulation, as we've mentioned before, solved these completely cardiotoxic effects that had never been seen before. Up until this date, I don't think...
Wait, are these the cardiotoxic effects that were not available to the public? That she said...
Yes.
That, you know, so you all identified in secret, not known in the art, that there were these effects. So how does that work? The cousin of that is a long-felt need. If nobody other than your clients recognized this problem, then how can you describe a person skilled in the art as having this long-felt need? Isn't there a tension there? Do you understand my question?
I do. And I think it's because, and there are not that many cases like this in this court's jurisprudence, but when you discover a problem in the prior art that nobody knew about, and you discover that problem, some cases like the... Novartis v. Bayer case actually said discovery of the problem alone would be enough. But here, not only did we discover the problem, we solved it with a completely unknown solution.
Yeah, but I'm troubled by the discovery of the problem. In her motivation analysis, she relied pretty heavily on the fact that there was no motivation because there was no recognized problem in the art. And then you come over to secondary considerations, and she says there was a long-felt need because there was this problem, I guess the problem that no one skilled in the art knew about except for your clients. Do you understand?
I understand exactly what you're saying. And I think for her motivation, the analysis was the way we read the opinion, the way we argued it, it was separate. There was motivation and then separately discovering an unknown problem and solving it with an unobvious solution. In terms of motivation, the motivations that was before, well, now, was bioavailability. That was really the only motivation they argued, and somewhat compliance, but not really. On appeal, they abandoned bioavailability basically because the evidence was so much against them, they abandoned it.
Because she gave a claim construction, which is less relevant.
But she said stuff way broader than that. There would have been no reason for a skilled artisan to abandon the oral administration in favor of sublingual, a dosage never before used by antipsychotics. I mean, she seems to say in her motivation, there was no motivation. And she recognizes, and that's correct under the law, that you all was not one skilled in the art. She doesn't give them credit for this problem that you solved. So I have a hard time seeing how then, kind of in fairness, but under the law, that you can get credit for long-felt need, but we're saying nobody knew about it. Well, long-felt need suggests that the public had a long-felt need, and you filled that long-felt need.
Well, we filled that long-felt need with a drug other than risperidone and clozapine that didn't have the horrible movement side effects.
Drug, not the need for the particular mechanism of administration.
Right. That is correct, and the district court, that was an argument raised with the district court, and the district court found that if not for the sublingual form, this drug would never have seen the light of day. This is a new chemical entity. This drug was not on sale anywhere. It was only because of the sublingual form.
But people didn't know that there was a need for a sublingual form to avoid the heart problems. correct?
Correct. And to get back to Judge Prost's question quickly, those findings that she made, that everything was working fine, the prior art, everything looked good, that was for the bioavailability. Remember, their main argument below was that you would go to sublingual because the prior art was showing that there were problems, there were bioavailability problems, and the district court said that's not correct. Everything was looking fine in the prior art, so bioavailability wasn't a motivation. But
well,
separate.
That may be in the context of a sort of reading, but her statements are quite broad, and they're not limited to bioavailability. I think they argued a few other things there. They're clearly, you're correct, their emphasis before the district court, because as Judge Moore pointed out, seems like it was because the claim construction kind of switched to what they thought at the end. And they may have to suffer the consequences of that, but that explains why they were doing it. But long-felt need, tell me again, the long-felt need had nothing to do
with the cardiotoxic effects, nothing. Long-felt need had
but it was because this drug was better than these other drugs with side effects. What does that have to do with the claims, both of which are confined to this method of taking the drug, not to the drug itself?
That's correct. But, well, claim one is during prosecution, as was discussed earlier, was limited to sublingual.
But it's not a patent on the drug, so long-felt need for the drug can't very well relate to this patent.
It is a patent on the drug, isn't it? I mean, I'm confused.
It's a patent on...
Claim one is
a composition that's sublingually administered,
yes,
that rapidly
still,
disintegrates.
That's a composition claim. It's not a
medical
claim.
Yes, that is correct.
And yeah, but you get the claim. The only reason you got it is because the prosecution history required that you add in the method of sublingual.
Correct. Right. And this
you
argument.
You couldn't have gotten a patent on the drug alone.
That's no. Not on the drug alone. No, absolutely not, because that was in the prior art. But that's sort of the point. That drug would have never seen the light of day because it would cause, I mean, we had two patients. One of them took an IV, collapsed, almost died, had to be revived.
Yeah, but nobody knew that.
Talking about. Nobody knew that.
You can't say there's a long-felt need.
but that's not part of the long-felt, that's not part of the secondary consideration of long-felt need. That is the Leo Pharmaceuticals, the discovery of an unknown problem and solving it with an unobvious solution. That's exactly what happened in Leo Pharmaceuticals. In Leo Pharmaceuticals, there was these combination of vitamin D and corticosteroids, and the prior art said there were these aqueous solutions, and they said surprisingly they worked great, and everything was happy. And then Leo discovered, well, wait a second, unknown to anyone in the art, that when you tested these particular formulations, they had degraded storage stability seriously, and they solved that problem. And this court said, well, that you recognized a problem unknown in the art, and you solved it with an unobvious problem. No one in the art knew about these storage stability problems in Leo Pharmaceuticals. No one. But they found it, and they solved it, and that was worthy of patent. Here...
Yeah, there's another difference here, and that is that the long-felt need is not related to the asserted motivation to combine that we're dealing with here, which is for people who have difficulty swallowing. There is your long-felt need argument has nothing to do with that motivation, right?
The long-felt need
is
has
that
to
correct?
Do with...
But
no,
that would be
it's
okay.
Not.
But it would be okay if it did. I don't understand why you're running away from that. Your long-felt need argument has to do with other symptoms or side effects that are going to be cured by this disease. You can have a long-felt need for a product, and it doesn't necessarily have to correspond at all to the concept involved in motivation
of mind. But the long-felt need has nothing to do with this. What these patents are about, which is the method for administering a drug that was in the prior art.
If we had not come up with a sublingual form, acetampine would never have come into being. It would have never been sold. It would have never helped thousands of people, the drug would have just withered on the vine.
I want to take you back to motivation to combine, and in particular the district court's opinion on pages 72 and 73. Can you open it up for me?
Sure. I'm here.
Do you see at the bottom where she says this is a specially persuasive reason given patient compliance concerns and the special instructions doctors need to provide when taking sublingual forms? That particular sentence is not limited to schizophrenic patients, correct?
No, it is not.
Okay, the next sentence, says, as explained by Dr. McIntyre, in treating schizophrenic patients, he understands that this is a particular issue. So that sentence does seem to be directed to schizophrenic patients, correct?
Yes.
Okay, then the next sentence is defendant's own expert or clinician, Dr. Holland, agreed sublingual administration would not improve patient compliance. That, again, is not limited to schizophrenic patients.
That's correct. Correct?
The best part is if you go to that testimony, which is in the appendix, now I'm going to ask you to open up the appendix. At Dr. Holland's testimony at page 442 of the appendix. Dr. Holland was defendant's own expert. Dr. Holland testified, as best as I can tell, on page 442, block 705, in about lines 15 through 25.
Yep.
That he talked about patients in general having trouble swallowing. This is a part of his redirect, which begins at 702. Nowhere is the word schizophrenic mentioned anywhere in that redirect in that section.
That's it? Correct.
And Dr. He was testifying about patients in general, not limited to schizophrenic.
That's how we read that testimony. In fact, part of his testimony was about other uses for acetamine.
And this is a question of fact that we have to give deference to the district court on. So if she read the testimony the way I read the testimony, the way you read the testimony, we'd have to give that deference, correct?
Absolutely.
All right.
If that's what she said.
Can we move on to the cross appeal?
Sure.
Because your time is running.
Sure.
Oh, just one other quick thing. I just want to say because it was in their reply brief. In the appellant's reply brief, they stated that we basically lied about saying that there was a patently false statement in one of the articles that we published, and that's not true.
Wait, are you talking in the yellow brief? I go in colors.
Yes, they're...
What page are you referring to?
Page 19. In talking about a Vrijemud article, which is at A1306...
Is this Organon?
Organon.
Organon.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, anyway, they say that there's a statement in the article that there were no clinically relevant adverse experiences have been reported up to date, and they say that statement is false because of the two cardiotoxic events we've had before.
What does this have to do with Claim 4? Did I miss something?
No, this is back on the original. I just wanted to bring it up because we didn't have a chance to reply to it since it was in their reply brief.
Okay, why don't we move on to something else?
Okay.
That's your point.
Okay. Claim 4, excitation. All excitation is there's an abnormal level of excitement. And this is what our expert testified, there's an elevation of an individual's thought, an individual's behavior, an individual's mood. And the district court on claim construction, or very early on in the case, ruled that it excluded the mania associated with bipolar disease. And we contend that was an error of law, that there's nothing...
And you clearly preserved your argument in that regard? Because there's so many things going on in this case, in claim construction early, claim construction later.
Yes, we argued that absolutely at the time in terms of claim construction. And we lost. And then
you cross-appealed it to us.
And correct. We cross-appealed it to you. And in the opinion, in the district court's opinion, she specifically ruled, I am not changing my claim construction ruling. So there was three bases. One is the district court found, well, the word bipolar isn't in the spec, and therefore it doesn't include the mania associated with bipolar disease. But again, there's no requirement that bipolar be in the spec. Excitation is a feature of mania, and our drug isn't used to treat bipolar disease because bipolar has mania and depression. Our drug treats the mania aspects of it. It doesn't treat bipolar. So we think that argument is legally.
And how does that affect your case, the cross appeal on inducement? And, well, I guess we're talking direct infringement.
Yeah, it doesn't affect our case unless we lose on the claim construction of claim one. But assuming we win that, it doesn't affect our case for the defendants here. This is a Rule 54B case.
So then you tell me, what should I do? So I'll just tell you. I think she got it wrong on unexpected results. I'm a wear it on my sleeve kind of gal. I think she got it wrong on unexpected results. So what do I do with that? I'm inclined to say I'm going to vacate and remand on claim one with regard to obviousness. So then tell me what happens to claim four.
Well, claim four then becomes very important because then we have to prove that all the defendants infringe claim four. There's only two who aren't, there are two who admitted infringement.
Well, keep in mind I said vacate and remand. I didn't say reverse on obviousness, right? Vacate and remand.
Is there any difference between claim one with her claim construction of claim one and Claim 4 from the point of view of obviousness?
No.
There's no difference.
There's no difference.
So if we had a concern about the obviousness analysis for Claim 1, that would also apply equal force to Claim
4. It would. But again, our contention is there's no motivation to make a sublingual centipene for Claim 1 or Claim 4.
Okay, so get back to the cross-appeal.
Cross-appeal.
Yeah.
So
how that's affected by anything on this
For the defendants here, it really wouldn't affect them, because assuming we win on Claim 1, because they all admit and they all were held to infringe Claim 1, but we have another defendant in a this was a Rule 54B case, and we have another defendant, we just recently had a trial, who contend they don't infringe the 30-second limitation of Claim 1.
Wait, why are we caring? I mean, that's another case, and other parties in another
case. It's the same case. So if we're stuck, but they would infringe Claim 4. So if we're stuck.
But are they parties to this case?
Yes.
If we were to agree with you on the cross-appeal, leaving aside maybe it will remain open because of obviousness, what impact does it have to the parties in this case?
Sigma Farm is a party to this case. They are defending the claim construction on Claim 4 because it affects them, and they could potentially be infringed Claim 4 but not infringed Claim 1, depending on what happens on this trial that we just had. But Sigma Farm is part. The case is titled Forest versus Sigma Farm. Sigma Farm is a party. They were in that first trial basically on the claim construction issue of Claim 4. We had a separate trial on whether they infringed Claim 1, but because of the district court's claim that they don't, it will be held that they don't infringe that. They agreed to be bound by what happens with Claim 4.
So they're listed as appellees in this case, right?
That's right, because we're cross-appealing the claim construction that really applies to them. And the others. But
If, in fact, we were to conclude that the district court's construction of Claim 1 is wrong and that it's broader than sublingual or buccal administration, the district court did not address the obviousness question that would be presented by that claim construction, correct?
No, she did not. However, the record on appeal, I think, is pretty clear that it would not be obvious, even if it included, you know, the broadly or any tablet that dissolve within 30 seconds based on the rationale of Bear v. Watson, where there was nothing in the prior art even suggesting that combination.
But she didn't decide it.
She did not decide that specifically, no.
So let me ask you another question, going back to my hypo.
Yes.
You didn't say something to me that I thought you were going to say, so I want to ask you directly, if I have a problem with unexpected results, but I don't have a problem with your motivation combined, do I really vacate and remand?
No.
Well, yeah, you let me say that before and you didn't say anything.
No. No.
So if I think there is no motivation to combine, you know, but what about like In Re Cyclobenzaprine? We've got all these cases that say you always have to consider the objective considerations. And what if here I think she got one of those considerations wrong, but she didn't mess up on what I traditionally would call the prima facie case?
Those secondary considerations, particularly those, and there's some other secondary considerations like simultaneous invention which work against the patentee, but the ones unexpected results favor the patentee. So if there's no motivation, that's
okay,
the
so
end of the
analysis.
So
they didn't make basically their prima facie case. It doesn't matter whether she got wrong that extra stuff like the icing on top of the cake that favored you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How do we know that based on her analysis? Because there's no conclusion, as I can find it, on her motivation analysis. We have no idea whether she kind of held firm and then sort of, because ultimately the fact that she wasn't iffy on the motivation, she made the analysis, but she found very strongly for you on a couple of major secondary considerations. So how do we necessarily know that didn't weigh into her analysis?
Is there a fact finding somewhere on motivation, in her opinion?
I think it was just... I think the fact findings are between 70 and 73, and she comes out pretty clearly that there was no motivation. And I think that's a separate basis, A70 to 73.
No, that's three pages. She comes out pretty clearly there should be a sentence. Where's the sentence?
Well, she goes through each of the articles and explains why each of them wouldn't be motivated.
Yeah, but she doesn't make a specific finding about motivation, right?
Well, she says Wani would not have motivated a skilled artisan to make a sublingual dosage form to
address... Where are you?
This is A72. Again, remember, the main argument that they raised...
Where are you reading?
This is page A72.
Where?
in the 1, 2, 3, 4, fourth line, talking about Motwani, which was their key argument, and it's on appeal, their key prior art reference.
But that's the bioavailability.
Well, that was...
That's off the table. I mean, they're not arguing anymore. The fact that she made a finding that there was no motivation for bioavailability is irrelevant. Where did she make a specific finding with respect to the other alleged motivations?
That would be, I think, the language that Judge Moore was pointing to on the top of A73 when she was talking about compliance.
Can I ask you, red, did you...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, Judge.
In your red brief, sorry, did you call out that you don't even have to deal with these secondary considerations if you affirm her on motivation?
Yes, I think we said that we win on motivation alone, and you can affirm on that basis, and we also win on the... discovering an unknown problem and solving it with an unknown solution. Independently, I think we win on both. And we certainly argue that at trial.
Well, where did you say that you win regardless of the findings on secondary considerations?
In our red brief?
Yes.
If you want, I could, on rebuttal, I can find you the page, but... Rather than, would you like me to do it now? I can try to find it.
If you can find it now,
quickly.
It helps.
I mean, I'm looking at page 44, just because that's the only place you cite in recyclability, which I assume would be.
So the way we set up the brief, we had two arguments. One, the district court properly found that the inventor discovered the unrecognized problem, which, as I said. And then two, the district court did not clearly err in finding that a skilled artisan would not have been motivated to make sublingual centipede formulations. That entire section from pages 30 to 40 of our brief is not dealing with the cardiotoxic events. It's just on the motivation.
Okay.
And our position is that we win. And then, three, we say they also did an error in finding the objective indicia supports us, unexpected results in long-term need.
No. But my question is, maybe I didn't make myself clear. Did you ever say the court doesn't even need to affirm on the objective evidence because she was right on the motivation? So even if you were to reach those, do you ever call out that the analysis is not contingent on the way on the motivation?
Yes. On page 30. We go through all of them. But separate and apart...
I'm sorry. I'm turning to page
30. Page 30 in the brief, line under section 2.
Uh-huh.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down.
Yeah.
Are you there, Judge Gross?
Yeah. Where
but separate and apart from solving the unknown problem, this court can affirm the non-obviousness based on defendant's failure to prove by clear and convincing evidence that a skilled artisan would have been motivated to combine the teaching of the prior art reference to achieve the claimed invention.
Okay. All right. We'll save a little rebuttal time.
Thank you.
You need help.
May I proceed?
Please.
So if I could just make one point on the compliance motivation. The testimony cited by the district court was referring to the period after Saffris was launched. We saw that
What about the point that we were discussing, that there is this evidence in the record, including an article by the plaintiff's own witness, saying that difficulty swallowing is a motivation. And the question is whether her findings and whether the evidence in the record conclusively establishes that there is no motivation to provide the sublingual form for people who have difficulty swallowing who do not fall into the schizophrenic category.
And I would agree with Your Honor that it's not clear from the district court's decision. And I would also agree that Forrest's own expert...
What's not clear from the district court's decision?
The district court did not make in our view, a specific finding that sublingually administered or rapid disintegrating compositions would not help with compliance with people who have difficulty following, other than patients with schizophrenia.
She doesn't make a specific finding about the motivation to combine based on the difficulty in swallowing. She doesn't specifically address that, though she does have some discussion of the testimony relevant to that.
I agree, Your Honor. And I would just like to point out that that both experts agree that that as of 1994, a person of ordinary skill believed that that an orally disintegrating tablet could help with compliance. That's what it says in the prior art in 1994. And both experts agree that compliance was a problem in the schizophrenia population. Now, the prior art says how to solve that problem. The prior art says that the problem was that the patients might cheek the medicine, put it in the cheek and spit it out. And that was a problem acknowledged by Dr. McIntyre as a problem in 1994. Now, the testimony that the district court cites was about after Sapphris was launched in 2009, but as of 1994, we had a problem that both psychiatrists agreed existed, and we had prior art telling you how to solve that problem. And turning back to the cross appeal, if we go to column one...
Well, let me ask you one other point that we raised with your friend, which is that if we were to agree with the district court's findings with respect to motivation, why is there a need? I mean, even if we think her analysis of the secondary considerations was a bit off, why do we even have to go there if we agree with her on motivation? Is it clear to us that it was all part of one big whole and it was a weighing thing or whatever? Is there anything you can point to?
Well, in part, the district court relies for its motivation finding on this solving an unknown problem. And that's all wrapped up with the unexpected results. So if you find that there wasn't an unknown problem that was solved and that there were no unexpected results, then it would need to be remanded. But
so you think the two are kind of cousins, and so one,
right,
our analysis of one undermines the other.
Why?
One additional reason, and that's claim one as properly construed.
Yeah, but okay, stop that. So just why would we send it back if we found that she had made a fact finding of no motivation to combine? And I'm seeing Judge Dyke's point about the absence of an express fact finding. While she has a paragraph that really makes it clear to the world where she's going with it, it doesn't sort of conclude with that wonderful sentence you'd like, therefore I find no motivation to combine, kind of express, clear sentence. At best, I think honestly, I now realize it's at best implied in that paragraph that spans 72 to 73. But that paragraph, it doesn't seem to me, has anything to do with the long-felt need or results, because the unexpected results have to do with a medicine that overcomes a heart problem. What does that have to do with that there's a motivation to put it in a particular form that dissolves in the mouth rather than some other form of administration?
Because Forrest argued that the motivation was derived from this unexpected result of...
There's nothing about that in her opinion. There's nothing about that. Her opinion on 72 to 73 on motivation to combine is about whether or not somebody of skill in the art would believe that the sublingual administration would improve patient compliance in these particular type of mental health scenarios. That's what her discussion is about. It's not about unexpected results anywhere. There's nothing even vaguely relevant to the long-felt need or unexpected results in her discussion of motivation to combine, which spans 72 to 73.
It's not in this discussion, but in the opinion, the district court discusses...
It's not in here. So Judge Prost's question to you, and it's important to me to try and figure this out, is if there is, in fact, a finding of motivation to combine, a question which I'm starting to really question, but if there is a finding that she made, an express finding, that regarding patient compliance, there's no motivation to combine, why wouldn't that end the case, even if there are problems with her secondary consideration evidence? Because you would have failed to prove your prima facie case at that point. Her secondary consideration things are only things that would otherwise favor them. And if you fail to make your prima facie case, why do I care about the stuff at the end that might also favor them?
It is all wrapped up in the cardiotoxic side effects, because one of the reasons why Forrest has argued that you wouldn't use sublingual is because if the patient swallows, it would defeat compliance because then it would cause the cardiotoxic side effects.
I thought you might have said, I don't know if this is the case, I'm just looking at it again now, but it seems to me that she made certain findings with respect to the long-felt need that seemed to suggest that there was, I'm looking at page 76, the last paragraph becoming in addition. It seems to me like your answer might be that if we're going to reevaluate the motivation factor, that her finding on this page seems in tension with her findings on motivation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, they do seem related.
That's the right answer.
Okay. You could have just gone with yes. It was really a friendly question. You know, mine were hostile, hers were friendly. I mean, you know, you should be able to spot them a mile away.
All right. Do we need more on the cross appeal? Were you going to give us more information on the cross appeal? Were you supposed to find something for you more?
Well, can I just direct your attention to column one, line 43. It says, such diseases include mental disorders such as tension, excitation, anxiety, psychosis.
Yes, but everyone, all the experts agree that excitation is not a mental disorder. Every expert testifies.
But what's claimed are disorders, not symptoms.
But there's no such thing as an excitation disorder. All your experts say so. So we have to read the rest of the spec. The other place where excitation appears makes it clear it's a symptom, not a disorder.
But even if you accept Forrest's expert's definition of how you understand excitation disorder
and by the
defining feature, bipolar mania is not an excitation disorder because the defining feature is not excitation.
Expert says there's no such thing as an excitation disorder, so stop using the words because they don't exist in the medical field.
Well, why would that language appear in the claim if it didn't mean something? It has to mean something. What does it mean in your view?
It's not entirely clear, and maybe the claim is indefinite. But
no, forget about it.
Even if we accept how Forrest experts understand the meaning, Forrest has said you understand it by the defining feature. The defining feature of bipolar mania is mood instability.
You're not answering my question. What does excitation mean in the claim?
Well, we know it means a disorder.
No, we don't. And you know what I think it means? Let me tell you. I think this claim should be read as a method for treating tension, excitation, anxiety, and psychotic and schizophrenic disorders. Why would there be two ands? If every one of these things was meant to be a disorder, why would it say for treating tension, excitation, anxiety, and psychotic and schizophrenic disorders? I think psychotic and schizophrenic, based on two ands, is what modifies disorders. And I think tension, excitation, and anxiety are their own independent things. They do not modify the word disorder by virtue of the second and. Simple grammar tells me that's the only way to read this. Tell me why I'm wrong. Do you ever strunk and white? Do you even know what strunk and white is? Maybe not. You're young. Tell me how, as a matter of simple grammar.
First of all, Forrest has always argued that excitation is a disorder in this claim. And second of all, I think we have to read that in the context of the specification.
What does it mean? It has to mean something, right?
Well, we know it doesn't include bipolar mania because excitation is not necessary even for
a
diagnosis of bipolar.
So you apparently know what it doesn't mean, but you don't know what it does mean.
And that's what the district court was asked to consider. And that's all that the district court needed to do to evaluate infringement.
Is your response to Judge Moore pushing back so heavily on whether or not this is a disorder or not, are you sort of claiming that your client was, or the patent owner was its own lexicographer? Because the sentence says, include mental disorders such as. So is that what you're trying to argue? That because the claim is defining excitation as a mental disorder. Is that your position?
Yes, so the patent defines excitation as a mental disorder.
And was there any testimony to support that?
Well, it was at the point of trial that was already settled that it was both sides were arguing that it was a disorder as claimed in claim four.
Right, but the other side preserved an argument on cross appeal. The other side preserved its argument, right, challenging the district court's initial construction. That was early on in the proceeding, right?
But Forrest did not preserve this argument that claim four can relate to a symptom and not a disorder. Forrest had argued that excitation in that in claim four was a disorder. And that's how the district court understood Forrest's argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I just want to briefly address the infringement of Claim 4, which is a separate, unless you have any questions on the other issues. But we hadn't talked about the one issue in the brief that we also crossed.
And this is part of your cross-appeal, right?
It's part of the cross-appeal,
yeah. Because it's direct infringement for inducement?
Yes. In other words, this is the skinny label. So they, when the district court reached its incorrect claim construction, excluding mania from Claim 4, they try to skinny label out schizophrenia so that they wouldn't infringe at all. But the problem is they left in the term atypical antipsychotic. And in that Takeda v. Westward case, this court looked at the label, but that case was distinguished a little bit in the Sanofi case where they said there's a difference between what happened in Takeda where the evidence was all outside the label versus Sanofi where they were like interpreting words in the label. And I think this case falls closer to Sanofi than it does to Takeda, in which an atypical antipsychotic for generations has been known as a method to treat schizophrenia. And unlike Takeda, where the court noted that there were many other ways to treat acute cases of gout, here, atypical antipsychotics are the first, second, third, and fourth methods under the guidelines to treat schizophrenia. So we think we have a good case that infringes Claim 4 and is distinguished over Takeda. And finally, we have something we normally don't have in many cases, is that because they skinny labeled after the claim construction.
You know, all of this was never argued on the opening. What your rebuttal is addressed to something that wasn't argued.
This is
here. It's argued in the briefs. It was not argued here.
That's right. I didn't get to that. That's why it was on. It's the cross appeal.
Okay, well, you're on rebuttal.
Yeah, you didn't address it. He didn't get a chance to respond to it. You can't stand up and do it at the last minute.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I'll leave that to the briefs. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We thank both sides, and the case is submitted.